This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm James Reed, Fantasy Author Publishing under JMD Reed. My first series collection is out. The first three books of The Storm Below are gathered in one bundle. When Ari and Shailene are drafted into the Autonomy's Navy, their love is stressed to the breaking. Assassins, dark gods, and demonic storm riders are all they hold dear. You can buy all of the Storm Below saga in two collections, books 1 through 3 and books 4 and 5. Today, I'm joined by Raymond E. Feist. He is the best-selling author of the epic fantasy universe, The Rift Wars Saga.
Hi, how are you doing today, Raymond?
I'm getting in there, you know, trying to make the best of what I think all of us will agree is a pretty horrible situation. I'm trying to stay positive. The news about the vaccines is really, you know, light at the end of the tunnel stuff. So I'm feeling okay. And I'm in the best place to live, I think. You know, San Diego, the sun is shining. It's in the 70s. It's a lovely day.
Yeah, it is nice down there in San Diego. I am in, which is, it's actually sunny today. So that's refreshing. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask a dumb question or two when I start this. So are you a cat person or a dog person?
Right now, neither. I mean, you know, I traveled enough that I only had pets when I had somebody living here. So, you know, I've had girlfriends and my wife and you know, cat, mostly cats. We had the occasional dog in our experience, but I like them both. if I wasn't adverse to putting a pet into a boarding situation when I travel, you know, because I had a girlfriend who did that, and that cat got so crazy every time we boarded it. I won't take responsibility. But if I had one pet now at my age, it would probably be a cat.
Okay. So when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
That's an interesting story. I was a horrible student. We'll start with that. And I mean, I used to have high school, I had three counselors. Most students get one. I got three. You know, I got the authoritarian old guy who was like, young man, you are just not trying your best here. But, and then I got the guilt tripping mother figure, Mrs. Inskey, who would say, oh, you know, Ray, you could do so much better. We have such high hopes for you. And then I had, I think it was Coach DeLeon, the football guy, was like, hey, buddy, just get by. You know how you work the game. Just, you know, get them off your back. And what nobody knew, including me, was I had a neurological problem. I had what is called a binocular dysfunction. And without turning this into a clinic on neurology, I'll just say think dyslexia, though it's not technically dyslexia. But it was one of those things where I had my own code in my head, which is how I could be a voracious reader. But I couldn't write to save my life. So I barely got by, only went to college to stay out of the Army. And then my father died and I had to drop out of school and do regular jobs. You know, I was in construction. I sold things door to door. I was a baby photographer, a variety of jobs. You'll find most writers get fired from jobs a lot until they finally figure out they're writers. And in my case, I went back to college. I finally got the means to it. And at that time, I was in my 20s. And rather than trying to stay out of the Army, I was trying to make something of myself. And a very long story, a short version was I ended up enrolling in a summer class right before the fall session. And the two courses I took were touch typing. And because I didn't know how to type, and Bonehead English, Remedial English.
Okay.
I had a brilliant teacher, and he made me understand that I already knew all the rules. I just didn't have labels for them. You know, I could speak in sentences. You know, but the touch typing thing turned out to be absolutely brilliant because it's different neural pathways. In other words, I wasn't trying to copy a letter. As I said, think dyslexia. I wasn't
right.
Mine didn't jump around on the page or anything like that. But I would reverse orders. In other words, if it was an I L, I would make it L I when I wrote it. that kind of thing. But when I learned to touch type, I saw a letter, thought of it in my head, and I moved a finger. And it was a whole new set of things. And suddenly I could type like a madman. And so I discovered I could write when I transferred to the University of California, San Diego. I had been at Grossmont Junior College. And I got English Student of the Year, for heaven's sakes, which probably if I had sent a copy of that to my high school senior English teacher, Miss Biggs, probably would have put her in a coronary. But I found I could get easy A's by writing papers. I could hack out a paper the night before it was due and get an A. So by the time I graduated, I was cum laude, and I never took a final. I always took every course I could that had a paper. So I goofed off, but I discovered I could write. And so we flash forward to I was working in the mass market and public opinion field. I was doing polling, and I was running some studies and things like that in the nonprofit sector, health and human services. And I'd done politics as well. So long story short, I got laid off because we had a tax revolt and all the funding for the university, San Diego State University's research program with California funds and matching federal funds, it all went away. And so I had been writing just to see if I could. I'd been involved in this gaming group in college, and I was writing silly stories. So I decided to get serious and write a novel. And I thought, well, if I can actually write something and sell it, then when I get another job, I'll have a side income. Well, I'm still waiting for that job interview 40 years later. Sold magician, and they wanted two more. And I said, okay, well, until I get a real job, this will work. And here I am 36 books later, still waiting for that job interview.
I remember reading Magician back in high school. I really loved it. So I'm glad that you figured out this whole being able to write thing, because it's, you know, those were some great stories you penned. Well, to think the world, like if you didn't have the right teacher.
Well, part of it is simply, you know, you discover you can do it or you can't. Everybody can imagine things. And people say to me all the time, I have this great idea. I just don't know how to put it on paper. And my answer is, and if you did, I would not sell anything, because if everybody could do it, nobody would buy my stuff. Writers have the one gift all non-writers don't. We know how to take an idea and fabricate a narrative, make a story out of it. And everybody daydreams, everybody imagines, everybody has a what if or an if only. You know, if I could be Superman, what would I do? You know, if I could win the princess's hand, if I could slay the dragon, you know, we all have those fantasies, you know. And I think that what makes it unique is that we like sharing them. And as most of us can't do it, there's a market. And I live a wonderful life. I have two brilliant children who, you know, adults now. I got good friends. I've traveled all over the world. So, yeah, I mean, this beats real work.
Yeah, no, I'm fortunate I'm able to support myself off my own writing. So I'm thrilled about that. Yeah. So you didn't intend for like the Rift War world, like spawn, like all these books, right? You just wrote it for a magician.
Yeah. See, when I did the first book, I didn't even know if anybody was going to buy it, let alone want a sequel. So when I wrote Magician, I wrote it as a standalone, but I buried stuff in the narrative that were like hooks for later stories. But I thought it was going to be a two-book thing. I thought there was going to be Magician and a book called A Darkness at Sethanon, which was going to cover the first Rift War. Well, the Rift War was an occurrence in the history of the game we played at UC San Diego. We played our version of a paper and pencil role-playing game, like a lot of people in my generation. Well, like a lot of people in my generation, a friend of mine, Conan Lamont, was up in Los Angeles at a gaming store, and he saw the original three pamphlet set of Dungeons and Dragons. Now, what we didn't was that it was a board game called Chainmail that Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson had written. And that all came from me. Well, what if, you know, one side or the other at the Battle of Agincourt had Gandalf? Okay, so that was the genesis of Dungeons and Dragons. We had no idea what those rules were, and we tried all kinds of stuff. I came into the group after they'd been doing this for a while, actually. So when I speak in the Royal We, I met, you know, Steve Abrams and John Everson and Conan Lamont and all the other people who were very active in that group over a number of years. Some still play, by the way. I mean, four or five of us get together and annoy each other once a month. Long story short, I asked a lot of questions about the world building, and the Rift War was how the great magic came to Midkemia. And I said, oh, how did it? And it was like, we don't know. It just did. And then when I started working on Magician, my friend Steve Abrams said, hey, why don't you tell the story of how the great magic came to Midkemia? Okay. I had no idea what I was doing. And I could do an hour just on learning how to write a novel by trying to write Magician and all the things I learned about the process. I was fortunate enough to be raised in a Hollywood family. My dad was a writer, producer, director. You know, he passed in 65. Before that, you know, he'd been nominated for a couple of Oscars back in the 30s. And, you know, probably the things that people most would recognize is he directed some Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea episodes. He actually, if you remember the old Lloyd Bridges show, Sea Hunt, my dad directed that pilot. And he was the line editor today. But back then he was the line producer of Peyton Place the year he died. So long story short, I always had writers around and I always listened to writers talking about stories. And my father and I would watch stuff together and he'd ask me what I thought of it. And I had osmosis to some degree. And when I started with Magician, I did not know how to write a novel. But I was blessed by a couple of things. And the short version of a very long story is I kept coming up with reasons to change how Magician evolved to the point where a big hunk of Magician got put in a drawer and resurfaced years later as like elements of the King's Buccaneer. Never throw anything away, guys. Keep it in a drawer. And when I finished Magician, I had a terrific editor at Doubleday named Adrian Zakon, and they were thinking of a big book. And my first thought was, oh, he's going to want me to cut stuff. And then he said, but we think it could be bigger. And you know, I'm trying to get the wax out of my ears, I'm hitting the side of my head, going, okay, no editor ever says that to a writer. And then he gave me a list of things that he wanted to see in the book. So I took a weekend and I wrote up a proposal and mailed it to him. This is back before email, folks. This was put a stamp on it and, you know, send it to the post office. And he came back and said, fine, that sounds great. And they made an offer. We made the deal. And it was a big chunk of money for that time, you know, at least enough that I could live on while I was still looking for that other job. And I wrote the first draft and sent it to him. It took about 4 months to rewrite the book with the material he wanted added. Just so if you're familiar with Magician, folks, the version I wrote didn't have Martin Longbow in it. It didn't have Squire Roland. It didn't have Arutha traveling to Krondor to talk to the prince and running into Jimmy the Hand. And it didn't have the Battle of Crydee. All of that stuff was added in because of my brilliant editor. And I sent him the book, and I waited. He read it, called me back a week later, said, great, that's exactly the story we want. Now cut 50,000 words out of it.
Oh, that's a lot of words. I
swear I was on the verge of tears.
That's almost
it was my baby.
Yeah.
S. Scott Fitzgerald said, you know, you got to be willing to kill your darlings. Yeah. And so I went through, and this actually ties in later. 10 years later, I reissued the author's preferred edition with a lot of the material Adrian had me cut. So at the end, 10 years later, we had the compromise edition that was actually the best version it could be. But I cut it, I wrote it, they published it, and it went out to deafening silence. You know, I got a couple of nice reviews, sold a few books. We did some German rights and some Japanese rights. And then, you know, we did had a paperback deal with a publishing company called Pinnacle, and Pinnacle went bankrupt right before they executed the deal. So Doubleday said, well, you know, we're going to try something we've never done before. We're going to put out a trade size paperback. For those of you who don't speak publishing, trade size means, you know, big, like the same size as a hardcover, but with a soft jacket. In the publishing, in the publishing industry, those are called limps. So we published it, and what they were trying to do, and I realized this later, was they were trying to duplicate the success that Del Rey had with Marion Zimmer Bradley's Mists of Avalon, you know, which had never been published in mass market. It's always been a large paperback, and it's just been in print forever. And they got the same artist, a wonderful Dutch artist named Ralph Ralt. In fact, I like that cover they did so much, I bought the painting from him. It's hanging in my office. And the book, and it went out, and it sold. And it got the attention of the salespeople at Bantam. And Bantam had just started a fantasy line called Spectrum. So it all came together, and I got a call saying, okay, yeah, let's do two more. And I went, let's do another book. And I did, I pitched them A Darkness at Sethanon. I said, well, we'll finish up this whole thing. And in my mind, I'm thinking, and we'll explain how the big magic came to Mikimia. Great, done. Over. Then I'll do something else, whatever it is. So I got halfway through the manuscript I was doing and sending chapters to my editor. And he finally said, this is getting to be a really big book, Ray. And I said, well, Magician wasn't exactly small. He said, yeah, but what do you think? And I said, I'm about a third of the way. He says, no, that's too much. We have to cut it. I said, so what, three books? And then there was silence at the end of the phone. He went, yeah, let's do a trilogy. And what happened was is that the concept I had for A Darkness at Sethanon getting split into Silverthorn and A Darkness at Sethanon, neither one of those books is quite as hefty a concept, I think, as I had originally for Darkness. But the two of them together are much better than I had. So it all worked out. And then I got, you know, the question from, by that time, Adrian was still working there, but I was also working with Lou Aronico over at Bantam Books. And so what's next? What do you mean what's next? Well, what happens next? The two bratty princes go off and do something. Okay, fine. So I wrote Prince of the Blood, and I really wasn't happy with it. And I got to rewrite it later to fix some of the problems with it. But then I got the request to do more, and I said, okay, I'll do King's Buccaneer. And out of the drawer came the stuff I had originally had in Magician that I put into that book. So it was still working. Then I changed publishers because Adrian left Bantam Bold Adele and went off to Morrow, which is now HarperCollins. And I followed him. And he said, well, I don't want to do a sequel to Buccaneer because I don't want to do a sequel to another publisher's stuff. And even long story short, I ended up with the Serpent Wars saga. And I had a couple ideas with that, which was one, I wanted to do anti-Pug and anti-Thomas, which is why Ruin and Eric are like, they're at heart, you know, nice characters. But Ru's a thief. He's a real bad actor. And Eric's got a violent temper when we first meet him. So they're flawed. But I got to redeem him. And I got to write a book to answer the question, who pays for all this stuff? When the king calls for an army, you know, and he's got to feed them and, you know, keep them together. And that's when I wrote Rise of a Merchant Prince. And then at the end of the series, I wrote, Shards of a Broken Crown to explain who cleans up the mess after everything goes to hell. But I was about a third of the way into Rage of a Demon King. And I was talking to Adrian on the phone. And it was nothing he said. It just hit me like a train. Oh, hell, I'm going to do all five Rift Wars, aren't I? And that's why it's 30 books long. Because, you know, I realized that I'm developing an audience for this that I never would have dreamt of when I started. For which, thank you. You know, you paid all my bills for the last 40 years. I thought this is great stuff. You know, I mean, not that my writing's all that great. That's up to the reader to decide. But I mean, it's a great process. It's a great way to live. It's a great way to travel and see the world on somebody else's dime. Can't ask for a better life. I'm the luckiest guy I know.
Awesome. Yeah, I think I know as a reader, like I always liked having a sort of a universe that you can just keep coming back to, as long as the stories are good and it's not getting, you know, stale or repetitive. Right. You know, you got to keep it fresh, but.
Well, that's an issue because writers are writers tend to fall into two categories. You know, there are the delusional writers who think their stuff is the best stuff ever written.
Yeah.
And I'll spare the embarrassment of naming names, but you can probably compile your own list. If you've been to a lot of science fiction conventions over the years, met a lot of writers, you have your own list. And then there are the writers who are delusional enough to think their stuff stinks and it could be better. And the question I ask myself all the time is, well, they're still paying you, aren't they?
So I know. You always have that voice like, this is garbage. And then people are like, this is really great. I loved it. I'm like, but I could have done better. I just, like, you, your grasp like always exceed your reach or whatever?
Is that how your reach should always exceed.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's always perfect in my mind, and then it never is quite perfect. But then that's the world, right? The world is never perfect.
Well, part of it as well is understanding the process of ideation. You know, I like I said, I grew up in a creative family. My mother was a professional singer before I was born. My stepfather, as is a writer, director, producer, my biological father, who died when I was very, very young, was a professional musician. That's where he met my mom.
And, okay.
And during World War II, they were doing USO shows together. But long story short, I ended up with the realization. In fact, somebody asked me a question once about 10 years ago, I think it was, maybe 15, that it was interesting because nobody had ever asked me this particular question. The interviewer said, well, what are you most proud of? Not which is your favorite book or, you know, the more traditional, but rather what are you most proud of? And I stopped and for a split second, I had no answer. And then suddenly it popped into my head. And that's that I have never had a book go out of print since 1982. You know, foreign language editions, yes. Not every publisher overseas publishes everything I've written. But in terms of my English language market in the United States and in the United Kingdom and the export markets from Britain, I have never had a book go out of print. Everything I've written is available. And I don't think there's a whole lot of books out there that were published in 1982 that you can still go buy in the bookstore.
Yeah, I can think of a handful of like sort of evergreen fantasy books that always seem to be on the shelves. But
well, you get Tolkien.
Yeah, there's not a lot.
And
obviously Tolkien.
Yeah, there's always Tolkien.
I'm thinking Eddings. Like I think you always find Eddings on the shelf.
Well, here's the thing about the deceased authors. If you're in publishing and you really pay attention.
Okay.
I'll use like Heinlein and Asimov. You know, all of their stuff rotates. In other words, their publishers will keep. I mean, especially Isaac. Isaac had like 500 titles or whatever the hell it was. Not all of which were fiction, obviously. Isaac had hundreds of books in print. So you go into the bookstore, you'll see maybe 20 or 30 of his titles. Same thing with Heinlein. You know, anybody who's like, go online to Amazon and or go to the local Barnes & Noble. You know, not until COVID's over, folks, but once you get back into a physical store, look and see how many titles are on the shelf. And then look how many titles can be ordered. Okay, so that's one nice thing about being alive. In addition to all the other obvious nice things about being alive, is that your audience is waiting for more, and that keeps the retail channel busy, if that makes sense. And
I
love hearing from my readers. And now with social media, we could do a couple hours on that. But one nice thing about it is that among many of the notes I get on Facebook or Twitter or wherever is I just gave Magician to my 13-year-old son and he can't stop reading it. And that is music to my ears. That is absolutely lovely.
I understand what you mean. Yeah. I don't get a lot because I'm not like no one really knows me, but whenever someone does, it always makes my day. And I'm always really thankful that they took the time to read, you know, my writing because we're all busy and they could have read something else. But
well, I've got age problems, among other things. I am word blind by the end of the day. And also, I discovered the older I got, the more reading other people's fantasy started creeping into my own. When I first started, I didn't have that problem because I was a voracious reader and I had this like firewall in my head between what I was reading and what I was writing. But, you know, about 20 years ago, I started noticing that if I was reading a particular author, I was slightly beginning to mimic them, which is not a healthy way to go.
No.
So I don't read fantasy anymore. People will say, you know, can you recommend something? And I say, look, my taste is just the same as anybody else's, maybe very different from yours. But I read biography and I read history. You know, because that doesn't influence me, except sometimes it inspires me. Two history books, or a history book and a biology. Well, okay, there's a mix. I mean, certain history books tend to be bios. But the first book that I can point to off the top of my head that's a nonfiction book that reads like fiction and fired my imagination and gave me a bunch of ideas was a wonderful book called Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare by Stephen Cornblatt. And it's another one of many biographies of Shakespeare. But this one did something very original. He didn't try to decipher all the stuff that was known about Shakespeare from, you know, other sources, which is a very traditional historical approach. He looked at all the empty spaces and inferred what Shakespeare was doing from what he knew about the culture. For one example, there's the so-called lost years, where basically after Shakespeare's father started going down the drain business-wise, his father had been a very successful glover, making gloves for nobles and wealthy, you know, merchants. And Shakespeare's father was a drunk, and the business went south. And that's why he married his wife, was because she was a rich widow. And he, you know, took advantage of the situation, apparently. But he vanished, and then he showed up years later in London, like 2 or 3 years later. And nobody knows where he went, but Cornblatt uses what he knows about the culture, the history. For instance, I didn't know this until I read the book, that supposedly Elizabethan England was incredibly regulated. You had to have like documents to travel to London if you were out in the West Country or something like that. So you could find documents in, you know, it was a really legislated, very well kept set of, you know, marching orders.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were happy-go-lucky for records. So, you know, he came to the conclusion that what Shakespeare was doing is because of the politics, that he was tutoring the children of wealthy Catholic nobles who were hiding the fact that they were Catholic, you know, and which is why they wouldn't send their children to somebody local who was a Protestant, in case the kids screwed up and said something and gave away the fact that the family was Catholic. And he builds a very persuasive argument for that. And there's a whole bunch of that stuff in the book. It's a book I highly recommend for people who are interested in Will Shakespeare. The other book is one I haven't read yet. I just ordered it and it just arrived. It's from a terrific historian named Thomas E. Ricks. He won a Pulitzer. It's called First Principles.
Okay.
Listen to this. See, if this grabs you, you'll want to order it. If it doesn't, you'll ignore it. It's called First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How They Shaped Our Country. Given what we've been going through politically, the idea of norms, the idea of tradition, the idea of robust institutions is predicated on a bunch of stuff that I'm sure is going to be talked about in this book when I get to it. So that's what I read, and that's how I work. So your next question.
Yeah, I was curious. Are you like a heavy outliner, or do you kind of just write by the seat of your pants?
Well, actually, I use the tip of my fingers. Seat of your pants, you don't get good typing. Seriously, I learned one thing doing Magician the way I did it. You got to know where the story ends. If you don't know where it ends, you're going to wander like Moses in the wilderness for 40 years. Okay, so you got to know where you're going. Now, how you get there, it's part of the adventure of writing. You know, my daughter is a terrific first reader. She's got some really good writing chops on her own. If she ever decides to turn pro, I'll give her all the help I can. But I have these elements in the book I'm working on now, Master of Furies. It's book 3 in the Fire Main sequence, you know, the Fire Main saga. And
okay.
It's like moving parts. It's like I got this story bit over here with Hava and Ha Tushale, and then I have this bit over here with Baron Dumarche, and then I have this story arc here with Declan and the mercenaries, and so moving pieces around. And one of the things that happens in the writing process is you find that every decision you make has reverberations. It's like tuning an instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now if you play, like I played guitar badly when I was younger, it's like switching from traditional Spanish tuning to like open D with a bottleneck, and suddenly you're playing Delta blues. You're not playing Bach. You know, it's like,
okay,
you say, well, okay, if I start with Declan and the mercenaries, I'm gonna get Puccini. But if I start with Hava and Hatu, I'm going to get Beethoven. So what flavor do I want? And sometimes you can overthink that and sit twiddling your thumbs trying to make up your mind when what you need to do is just get off your lard and do it. But I talked to my daughter just this weekend, and I said, look, here's blah, blah, blah. And she said, and what I love about my daughter, because she's my first reader, she said, no, you want to start with Hava and Hatu Shale because you left the reader with some strong foundation. And then she, the way she talked about it, suddenly the light bulb went on over my head. And I went, damn, you're absolutely right. Sometimes we get forced for the trees, if you know what I mean.
I do get that. Yeah, no, I had to write a book with multiple storylines, and it hit taught me a lot of lessons on like how to write. It's different when you have just like one storyline that you're moving from start to finish, but when you have multiple storylines, you start to realize how things impact, and it, like, I had to really figure out my writing because it was still very early on in my career, you know.
Well, part of it for me was being a movie guy, you know, a TV guy.
Okay.
When your father comes home, you know, when you're 13, 14 years old, and your father comes home and you're talking about, you know, and I got to see it from both sides. I was on my first movie set when I was 7 years old. Okay. You know, yeah, no, people, here's a little story about fame. I had a young actor who wanted to get Magician for free, and his career's been pretty noticeable since he was a young, brand new actor. And so he arranged a meeting in LA, and I drove up and got a nice lunch on the west side of LA, you know, in Beverly Hills. And a large part of all the things he was talking about was, you know, I knew what it was coming. He wanted the rights, what they call fishing. He wanted to get the, you know, like an option on spec.
Yeah.
He wanted to tie up Magician with no money down. You know, which happens a lot. I mean, I've gotten a lot of nice lunches in L.A., you know, and a few decent dinners. And I even had a couple of guys come down here and buy me lunch in Del Mar or La Jolla. So I'm listening. And finally, I said, look, you know, you got to talk to my agent, you know, about the money part. And he said, oh, well, that's why we're doing this. I want you to be a part of this process. I want you to be, you know, putting, and I'm going, oh, here it comes. And he says, because you're very unlikely to get, if you just get a producer to get you an option, then they got to go get a talent attached. And I, you know, I speak Hollywood, so I knew exactly what he was talking about. And finally, okay, he looked at me and he had this expression like, this guy just doesn't get it. And I looked at him and I said, okay, I get the fact that you're the flavor of the month, young man. I said, but I met Clark Gable. And it was like the blood drained out of his face. And he said, you met Clark Gable? What was he like? Suddenly he was a fanboy, you know. So yeah, no, I mean, I met Clark Gable, I met Jimmy Stewart, I had lunch with Gene Kelly once at the Fox commissary, you know, just because it was, I went there on my break. I was working at Fox. I went on my break, and Kelly was sitting at a table near the door, and the maitre d' said, you know, I'm sorry, I can't seat you for another half hour. And I said, I got to get back to my office. And Kelly overheard me and said, oh, you can sit here, kid. So I said, I'm talking with Gene Kelly for like half hour. And you know, and actors and writers were coming into my home all the time. Lon Chaney Jr., my father had worked with him on a film called The Battles of Chief Pontiac. You know, I'd come home from school and there'd be, you know, his real name is Creighton. He used Lon as his, you know, his father's name professionally. But, you know, hi, Mr. Chaney. You know, I'm going to go to the kitchen to make a sandwich because I'm a, you know, 14-year-old high school kid who's hungry after snack. Yeah. You know, Gene Evans, the wonderful character actor. My father had worked with him in Donovan's Brain. My father was good friends with Sam Fuller, and Sam used Gene a lot. He had a movie about the first movie about the Korean War was called The Steel Helmet, and Gene was the star. Played a really interesting Sammy Fuller character. You know, not a nice guy, but you rooted for him anyway, even though he was a bastard. Very much early Sam Fuller anti-hero stuff. Long story short, I heard stuff that sunk in. You know, Cary Wilbur, who wrote the Space Seed episode of Star Trek that became, you know, the Wrath of Khan. You know, he was good buddy of my dad's, you know. Michael Fessier, one of the great short story writers, published a lot in the Saturday Evening Post, did a lot of screenplays, you know. I mean, I took all that stuff for granted. So when I wrote Magician, I was thinking in terms of a big scale movie with lots of characters, because, you know, that was the thing that surprised Adrian the most when he read it, was that I split Thomas and Pug up and I had parallel storylines centered around those two characters until I finally reunited them. And basically, you know, a lot of writers would have done one or the other. They wouldn't have done both. And that became my hallmark. You know, I have,
yeah.
In fact, one reviewer said, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember, but early on, he or she, I can't remember who wrote the review, said, Feist shifts point of view mercilessly, but he makes it work for the reader. And I thought, yeah, because I'm thinking jump cuts and crossfades and fade outs and fade ins. That, you know, that's the language I speak in my head.
Well, Raymond, it was really great chatting with you.
It's been my pleasure, and I thank you for your patience in the getting me to the computer today.
Oh, it's fine. We all have, you know, we all, like, I'm the most forgetful person in the world, so I just hope that the next person I like honor or whatever will be as patient with me. That's kind of my philosophy, right? You know.
Sounds good, you know, to me, my man. Yeah, it's like Whoopi Goldberg, you know, did a wonderful thing on Broadway called The Spook Show.
Okay.
And I think you can find it recorded. And there's a bit in there where she plays this character, Fontaine the Junkie. But she says something that stayed with me ever since I saw that, which was like 25 years ago, which is she's talking about Fontaine having gone to Amsterdam and he wanted to visit the Anne Frank house. He said,
okay.
You don't know what it's like to be the stranger until you are the stranger. You know, and he was talking about it.
Yeah.
The character, he was a character. You know, she was talking about asking for directions and how gracious people were and helping her. And then she said something that always stuck with me. She said, all it takes is a little bit of graciousness. And I look at the culture.
Yeah.
Day and the society you're in, and I go, we could use that so much right now. You know,
yeah, it's just, you know, it's the golden rule, like,
yeah,
do unto others as you would do unto you, as you'd want them to do unto you. You know, that's kind of what I would like, that's how I like to go through life.
Sounds good, my man.
So, it is. Well, you take care, Raymond.
You too, and thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I had a great time.
Okay.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my fantasy novels on Amazon. Follow news of my writing at my blog, jmd-read.com, and follow me on Twitter at jmdread. You can also join my reader group on Facebook, Fantastical Worlds of the Imagination. You can find more episodes of the podcast at fantasy-focus.com and wherever your favorite podcast is hosted.